Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We begin the show today by talking about dreams and the impact they can have on our history and on our culture with our guest, Bridget Vance. She is an associate professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton, teaches a course on the comparative history of dreams, and her research is on dreams and dream divination in the early modern China. Bridget has lived in China, Taiwan, and Japan, and so has a lot of experience in that part of the world. What are you wondering about how dreams have changed the way we all live? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bridget, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell you what, maybe we can start by talking about how you happen to stumble on this particular area of research, or maybe it found you. I don't know.
Probably a little of both. I think the topic sort of finds you in a way. I grew up very interested in dreams. My parents often asked me and my younger sister what we dreamed the night before, and you know, over oatmeal or scrambled eggs, we used to talk a lot about our dreams. And I suppose when I was in college, I started studying Mandarin Chinese and psychology, and I remember probably family, relatives, neighbors, what on earth do those two things have in common? And I often wondered that myself. And it was really later, I graduated from college. I was living in China. And one of my work colleagues, you know, I was working at an educational software company. And one of my colleagues said, I heard you're kind of interested in dreams. And I said, yeah. And he said, listen, I have a book that I think you might like to read. And he gave me a republication of a 17th century dream encyclopedia from China.
Wow.
And I was absolutely fascinated. And that's one of the reasons I decided to go back to school to get a master's and then ultimately a PhD. So it was, I would say, in a way, a chance encounter.
A chance encounter. And there's an encyclopedia of dreams. Do we have something like that in our country?
Well, there are actually, interestingly enough, there are copies of the original Dream Encyclopedia that was published, you know, in 1636 in China at the Harvard Yenching Library. So we actually, the United States, we have an original copy. There are so many incredible publications on dreams in every genre and every language imaginable. I think it's something that really fascinates people, not just historically, but also today.
Have you had some memorable dreams in your lifetime?
Oh, goodness, yes. So many. You know, in the course of doing my research, I learned about a practice called a dream incubation practice. And there's a temple in southeastern China that was historically very well known. People used to go there and they would pray for dreams in the hopes of, you know, having life's questions answered for them in the form of a dream. And in the summer of 2015, I was able to travel to this very dream temple and stay there for 3 days and three nights. And it was there that I actually had some very interesting dreams. Perhaps in part, you know, I was staying in a little hostel, and directly behind the hostel was a small farm, and the chickens and roosters and pigs woke me often out of a deep slumber. So I think I was well disposed to remembering those dreams as well.
What do you learn about another time and place by looking at how people approach dreams?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. You know, I think part of what we can learn is what was on people's minds, not just as individuals, but were there any patterns? I think the other aspect that really interests me is what did people in different times and places think dreams meant, and why did we dream, and for what reason do we dream? And these are some of the questions that we can begin to answer when we look into dream records, written ones. That's primarily what I've been working on, but you know, there are many other ways of accessing dreams. I think some people do digital recordings of their dreams now, but historically that was not possible.
Well, Mark and Bloomer wonders if you know anything about vivid reoccurring dreams, and have you heard of that happening in history?
Oh, yes. There are certainly records that, I'll just use an example from this dream encyclopedia that I have studied. It's 36 volumes. It's, 12,000 pages. It's pretty hefty. And within that dream encyclopedia, there are entries in which it's clear that there are individuals who have basically the same dreams, and that there are also folks who have different people who have the same dreams. And so there are questions then about what does that mean if I have the same dream as someone else? I've met a few people who work currently in sort of in a contemporary context with dreams that that come up again and again, and it's almost like you can't really shake them. But I think people have very different approaches and different answers to what that means for them. And I suppose that's maybe one aspect of dream interpretation that I find a little bit perhaps more compelling, is that it really does matter what the individual dreamer thinks about their dreams. You know, the meaning of a dream needs to resonate for the dreamer in order for it to really, for the interpretation to stick, let's say.
Yeah. Well, your research is focused on early modern China. So maybe you can give us some context about that time period in China. And by the way, when was the early modern China?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? You know, you ask a historian about periodization and it can sort of go on for hours. Briefly, though, this is, you know, China had a dynastic history up until the beginning of the 20th century. And, early modern really refers to, I would say, primarily the last two dynasties in China. So I'm looking at the 1600s, primarily late 1500s, 1600s. And at least in China, this is sort of right before a dynastic shift. So from the Ming Dynasty to the Qing Dynasty, it was a time of chaos, many would say, of ambivalence, of unruliness. And you can sort of see that in the political structure, right? Anytime you have the end of an era, the end of a dynasty, things got very complicated. It was also an era marked by climate change. This was the so-called Little Ice Age. So things were, I would say, complicated climactically. It was also a time in which there were many, many people. So the folks who I'm studying were highly educated, read, wrote, worked on a lot of different topics. And they were really, they received their education and their training really primarily with the purpose of working for and in the bureaucracy. That was sort of why people got an education. And it was a moment in Chinese history in which the sort of the emperors at the end of the Ming Dynasty stopped filling bureaucratic positions. There was attention turned away from what was happening in the provinces. And I think for a lot of these educated men, they were quite frustrated that a lot of their career paths had been cut off or curtailed. And some of them turned to dreams. And so we see this proliferation of publications about dreams in literature, poetry, and, you know, these dream encyclopedias, these huge projects of collecting information and publishing them. So that's a little context. I could dig deeper into the weeds, but hopefully that's enough to kind of chew on.
It does. It does give us enough to chew on. I'm wondering what kinds of dreams then they had back then. What would happen in a notable dream, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the things that I really was fascinated by, I would say, the most in this dream encyclopedia. You know, by this time, right, I'd studied Mandarin in college. I moved to China after I graduated. I taught for a year. I did an intensive language program. And I could read the characters, you know, and Chinese is written in characters. But there were parts of this dream encyclopedia that really I couldn't understand. I couldn't make sense of. And I love a good puzzle. So I found that absolutely fascinating. And one of the dreams that I couldn't, you know, I could read it and understand the dream, but I couldn't understand why the explanation was the dream of an emperor. And the entry in the encyclopedia simply stated that the emperor dreamed that the Yellow River had dried up. And that was it. And that the dream interpreter, there was a diviner who was present, and the encyclopedia then gives the divination, which said, things are going to be just fine. And you have the context. So the emperor was very worried that the Yellow River drying up would mean the end of his rule. You know, the symbol in China for ruler was a dragon, which was a water-dwelling creature. And he imagined, I think, that the dragon without water would die. Therefore, the Chinese state would crumble and fall apart. And I found this very interesting that the answer that the dream diviner gave was that the emperor would be just fine. The state would not fall. And it was really in digging into that a little bit further and consulting with my host father in Beijing, using these sort of old dictionaries and other reference books, that you can find a little bit more context to the dream. And the context to the dream helped me better understand why the dream divination was given in the encyclopedia the way that it was. And basically, if you take the character, the written Chinese character for river, and here in this context, it implied the Yellow River, the cradle of Chinese civilization. The Chinese character is made up of different parts. You know, it's not a phonetic alphabet the way that English is. And you can take these pieces of the Chinese character apart, and they reveal other meanings. And that's exactly what the dream diviner had done. He'd taken away the part of the Chinese character that means water in this character for river. If you take it away, you take away the water, you get a different character with the meaning that means you will be okay. You'll be able to be cured. The state will survive. And I just found that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Dreams and health. Did the Chinese see these two things connected, health and dreams?
Yes, absolutely. The dreams could indicate issues in the body. And I think also they sort of revealed for the dreamer sort of potential issues to look out for in an area that I guess today we might think of as morality rather than health. But I think historically in China, these were much more connected, that nightmares and dreams of a certain nature indicated moral failings that could lead to a kind of illness, which I also think is very interesting.
It is indeed. Bridget Vance, our guest today, historian and associate professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton. Fun talking with her about the cultural history of dreams. And you can join in, too. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the cultural history of dreams today with our guest Bridget Vance, historian, associate professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton. Great to have her with us. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I would guess that dreams have had influence over religion, too. I know there's mention of dreams as guidance from God in the Bible.
Yes.
What about in early modern China?
Yes, it's also the case that folks then believed many things about dreams, certainly. And one aspect of those beliefs was precisely that you know, they didn't believe in a Christian God, but that these were dreams were gifts in a way. They were messages sent from another realm. We can call it the spirit realm, otherworldly, if you will. And there was also this sort of belief. It's like, how did dreams work? How did we dream? And treatises that included information about different aspects of the soul. So there was an earthly soul and a heavenly soul, and these resided inside of people. And when they dreamed, the sort of the heavenly soul or the heavenly spirit would leave the body and would wander. And dreams were what that heavenly soul or heavenly spirit encountered while wandering. So, there were certainly many aspects, I would say, of spirituality, of religion, of religious practice that were very connected with dreams and with dreaming.
I was thinking about bad dreams because every once in a while, there's a bad dream that I have. It doesn't come up very often, but in fact, I know it's coming, and I try to wake myself up and often wake myself up because I know it's coming.
You know what's coming, yeah.
I know what's coming next. So every once in a while, I'll have a nightmare, and probably most people have in their lives. Historically, what role did nightmares play in China?
Oh, there's some very interesting beliefs about nightmares. So according to some practitioners of Buddhism, nightmares actually indicated these sort of moral failing on the part of the individual, that if your spirit was really calm and connected, you wouldn't have nightmares. So that was one part of it. And then the other part of it was there was a belief in a spirit that resided in people's households and kind of watched over the household. And every so often, that particular spirit would ascend to heaven and report on the moral transgressions of the household members. And there was a practice where people would try to stay up all night long the night that this particular spirit was supposed to leave the house and report on them so that it couldn't leave. So you know, if you didn't sleep, you wouldn't have the nightmare, and if you didn't have the nightmare, you couldn't get reported on.
I was a bad person today. I'm staying up all night.
Exactly. Better safe than sorry.
Oh, man. Colleen from New Holstein emailed us wondering if you know anything about the First Nations Dream Quest.
Oh, you know, I've heard of this. And I think it would be very, very interesting to do a little bit more work on. But it's, you know, this sort of rite of passage and a period of solitude and seeking personal growth through dreams and visions. And I think that, it, you know, although there isn't, I would say, there isn't an identical quest that I know of in early modern China, you can still see, I would say, some of the same impulses in the kinds of questions that people asked of their dreams, and also in these pilgrimages that folks undertook to go visit particular sites that were associated with dreams and dreaming.
Hmm. Let's go to Kenneth in Beloit now. Kenneth, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, Larry. I was wondering about comparisons of Western dream interpretation, such as provided by Carl Jung, and compared to her interpretation of the Eastern Chinese interpretations, as their guests done any of that comparisons?
So comparing Eastern and Western dream interpretations.
Yes. You know, a few summers ago, I was able to travel to Zurich, Switzerland, to the C.G. Jung Institute, and I took some courses there. I was very interested in comparative dream work. And I think one of the things that really struck me is, you know, in, I would say, in the Jungian approach to dreams and dream interpretation, there's this sort of sense of the quote unquote big dream, dreams that sort of transcend the individual, and then also the relationship between the sort of personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. And although you don't see that in the early modern Chinese context talked about in the same way. There's certainly this sense that there are symbols that transcend the individual, that have, I would say, a deeper connection culturally, that have meaning for more than one person. So I do see some parallels there. And I think also in terms of the attitude of what gets talked about and the attention to dreams. And I think for Jung, dreams were the path really to understanding. And one way of, I would say, accessing individuation, sort of this growth process in the individual. And I would say for early modern Chinese dreamers too, dreams offered clarity for an understanding of what was going on in their lives, not just as individuals, but also the ways in which they connected to one another. So hopefully that answered your question.
Kenneth, did that answer?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. So I'm trying to come up with, and maybe you've answered it in parts, but what methods did the Chinese use to figure out what their dreams meant?
Ah, yes, there are quite a few. There's, you know, one of them that I think is probably one that every culture uses is symbolism. So if you have a dream and it's about, you know, rain or mountains, right? You can kind of figure out what are the associations and what do those symbols mean. So one method of dream interpretation relied heavily on looking at the symbols in the dream. Another I refer to as resonances, and it has to do with, I would say, connections between some aspect of the dream and some aspect of waking life. And these can be historical allusions. These could be names of particular figures. These could be connections with previous dreams, anything of that nature. Another is glyphomancy. And this is something that I talked about earlier in the dream of the emperor who dreamed that the Yellow River dried up. And in that case, the dream diviner used glyphomancy, or the sort of dissection, the pulling apart of elements in Chinese characters. There's also homophonic interpretation. So if you dream of something that has the same pronunciation as something else, that can also sometimes reveal meanings of a dream. So I'd say those are probably the most common dream interpretation techniques that I've seen.
Okay. Jordan in Marengo has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jordan.
Hey there. I have an incredibly deluxe, very vivid, hysterical dream life. Parenthetically, my only reoccurring nightmare is that I'm chewing a piece of gum and I can't get it out of my mouth, and then the gum keeps expanding and expanding. And that's pretty scary in itself. But my main point question is, I'm only a survey sample of one, right? So, but through an amazing, amazing dream life that I look forward to, I just can't point to anything back in my past that's actually portentous in any way. So my question observation is, what do you think, like the percentage or ratio or even a historical meta perspective of what is actually portentous in dreams versus what do we wish it was portentous in dreams? Anyway, thanks. That's my comment, and thanks for the show.
Thanks, Jordan.
Oh, very interesting. Oh, wow. Thanks for sharing. The gum in the mouth dream, that I could, you know, as you were talking, I could feel it in my own mouth. And I just thought, wow, that's it's a vivid description. And I think that would be scary indeed. So it's interesting to think about dreams that foretell the future. You know, I have a friend of mine, his wife, about three times in her life has had a dream that told the future. And I don't want to put words into someone else's mouth, but, you know, in talking with her about it, she found that responsibility very scary. And I think that there's a fascination and a hope, just as you said, about what we'd sort of would love to know. I mean, goodness, if I had the ability to tell the future, I'd know exactly when to buy the lottery tickets. It'd be great. But I think a lot of the time, my guess is that it really is much more about offering, dreams are, you know, much more about offering us the chance to reflect on things that are sort of happening more or less in the moment, and processing. And certainly, you know, the recent findings from neuroscientists on the relationship between dreams and emotional regulation and memory consolidation. Those are some of the functions that we think of now. But I do think that there are these moments, these glimpses. I don't think I myself have had any pretentious dreams. but they're, you hear about them and you read about them, and that's, those are the ones that get recorded and that sort of call to us, that speak to us, because they're fascinating. And exactly as you said, we sort of wish for it, don't we?
Yes. Tab in Mesa Mani, let's go there. Hi, Tab.
Good morning. My question is, does what you eat and when you eat supper, does that have any effect on your dreams?
There's probably yes and no. I've heard so many, many people speak about the relationship between what you eat, when you eat, and what you dream. You know, just last week I was at a wedding and got up the next morning and had very strange dreams. And, you know, my brother-in-law said, oh, it's because we ate all that fried food at the wedding. You know, and I think, too, of Ebenezer Scrooge and A Christmas Carol, sort of suspecting that the Marley visit is because of what he ate. You know, there's more of gravy than of grave about you. So we see these references in literature and culturally, absolutely. And again, even in this early modern Chinese context, one of the sections of this Dream Encyclopedia lists all the relationship between the time that you have the dream and what the dream means. So I think there was this assumption that absolutely that the timing of what you eat and when you sleep does shift and impact your dream.
I was thinking about that. I just visited a daughter in Kansas for a week, and as usual, when I go someplace and sleep in a new bed, I always have dreams. And some vivid ones. And maybe it's the excitement of a trip or just being in a different bed that causes my brain to get going.
Yeah. I mean, I think anytime we move around, you know, we're a little unsettled, and things can absolutely happen when we change the context in which we're living and sleeping and therefore dreaming.
Dennis emailed us, when a caller asked about Carl Jung, Dennis thought about this. The concept of the shadow self is rooted in Jungian psychology, where the shadow represents the unconscious and the repressed aspects of the personality, and wonders, are nightmares from our shadow selves?
Yeah, I think that certainly some people would say yes, that it's the, you know, if we look at Jungian psychology, I think that the one interpretation would indeed be that it's, you know, psyche is trying to tell us something and bring something that maybe we're not that keen on, that that we don't know about. It doesn't necessarily need to be bad. It's just unknown or as yet unknown, and bringing it into the fore so that we can get to know that part of ourselves, that unknown.
How much value do we in the U.S. the culture place on dreams today, do you think?
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I suppose some level there's, I certainly see people who sort of poo-poo them and say, well, I don't remember my dreams and, you know, they don't matter. And then almost inevitably you start to talk to people a little bit more, and people have very interesting dreams, and we're curious. The human beings, we're naturally curious. And so it kind of makes sense to me that we do wonder, and we say, well, what's to it? We spend so much of our lives sleeping and so much of our sleeping lives dreaming, that is there meaning to it? And this is, again, where I think it really does depend on the individual. If you don't think it has any meaning, then it may not. But if you start to look at your dreams, they do begin to change. and respond. And I think it can be a very interesting process to think about them, to reflect on them.
And pay attention to them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It may say something about maybe the time we're living in. Who knows?
Yeah, you never know. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Bridget, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I'm always fascinated by talking about dreams, and it's interesting to hear about your research in particular. Thank you very much, and I hope we can do this again.
Oh, yeah, it was really a pleasure, and the questions were so interesting for me. So thanks to everyone who called or wrote in.
Bridget Vance is our guest, a historian and associate professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton. Well, did you ever have a dream about beer? I can't remember if I've ever had one about beer, but maybe I'll have one tonight because we're talking about beer next in beer making with our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look now at the chemistry of brewing beer, and we'll learn more about fermentation as part of this whole conversation as we visit with Brendan Blackwell as our guide. He's on the teaching faculty in UW-Madison's engineering department, and he's resides in chemical engineering, if I'm not mistaken, and he teaches a course on fermentation. And I bet it's a popular course. We'll find out about that, but we'll also take a look at the whole process of fermenting and fermentation and brewing beer with Brendan. And want to hear from you. Maybe you brew your own beer at home, or maybe you make your own yogurt or kimchi or kombucha. But I hope you'll join in. Give us a call as we talk the science of fermentation. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Brendan, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Excited to talk about the beers that our students have been brewing.
Yeah, I'm really interested in getting into that. But first, let's talk a little bit about some of the chemistry behind the whole process of beer. And I just off the top, it's how different is producing beer from wine? It's a lot different.
There are quite a few differences. The fundamental process is the same. You're using yeast to turn sugar into alcohol, but there are quite a few differences. Again, you're getting the sugar from a very different source. In the case of wine, you make grape juice. There's a lot of sugar already. In beer, you're starting from a grain, which is a seed that's a lot of starch, and the first thing you have to do is turn that starch into sugar that the yeast can eat. So there's extra steps there.
I would imagine. Water comes to mind too. Can you use plain old tap water? Do you need distilled water? What do you say?
No, so water is actually one of the key ingredients in the brewing process that people may be surprised to learn is very, very important. So, if you start with tap water, one thing is most tap water coming out of the tap is sterilized with chlorine. Chlorine is bad for brewing. It actually combines with some chemicals in the wort as it's fermenting to create what are called chlorophenols, which tend to have kind of a medicinal taste and can give you some off taste in your beer. So a lot of home brewers actually choose to start with, say, just buying jugs of distilled water from the grocery store is a good starting point. You can also get rid of the chlorine by running it through a carbon filter, or there's something called a Camden tablet, just a little thing you can buy at your local fermentation shop and toss in. But in addition to that, all of the little details of the chemistry of the water actually make a big difference in the final product. A lot of regionality in beer actually comes from breweries tailoring recipes to what their local water is like. So, for instance, one of the great things about brewing in today's day and age is that there's no such thing as a secret recipe. If you go to the internet and just search for clone recipe of your favorite beer, the recipe's out there and available. But one of the tricky things is if you start with Madison water and try to brew your favorite beer, which is brewed in California or Michigan or wherever, it's actually going to be a little different because of the actual mineral composition of the water. It makes a big difference in the final taste.
I was thinking about Hams beer. Hams back when I was a lot younger, the Hams beer commercials were water was always this crystal clear water was what they were always kind of promoting. And Hams is a lager, I believe. And
Well, part of it is you don't necessarily want completely pure water. If you do start with, say, distilled front water from the grocery store, you're actually going to want to add some things to it. That's part of the character of the beer, particularly calcium is a very important ion in brewing processes. There are a lot of weird off flavors that can come out of your beer if the pH is too high later in the process. And calcium ions will actually react to some things and act as something of a buffer, keeping the pH from getting too high and avoiding some off flavors. So if you actually do start from distilled water, it's very common to add something like gypsum to your water to make sure that you have the necessary minerals in there to make sure the process is going right.
Okay. Well, after water, the three main ingredients in beer are what? Malt, hops, and yeast, I believe. Is that right?
Correct.
Let's start with malt. What actually or exactly is malt, and how can brewers use it to change to the flavor they're trying to achieve?
Yeah. So malt is malted barley. Again, barley, the root word, that's where beer comes from. It's historically from barley. You can make beer out of other grains, but typically, if it's called beer, most of the grain involved is barley. What actual malting process is that's the activation of the enzymes that start turning the starches in the grain from into sugars. So what the grain actually is, the grain is a seed. So most of the mass of the grain is starch that the plant is going to use to feed the germ as it grows. So it's stored as starch for stability, but if you get it wet, as you would if you put it in the ground to start growing it, or if you just get it wet in a malt production factory, that's going to activate what's called the amylase enzymes that start converting the starches into sugars. So what you actually buy when you're starting to brew beer, this malted barley has been wetted to activate the enzymes and then dried to sort of start the process so the conversion doesn't happen again until you do that on purpose.
And are there things that a brewer can do to change the flavor with malt?
Yeah, so mostly that's done by the selection of what malt you use. So most beer recipes are 85% to 90% of what's called a base malt, which means that in the malting process, after wetting it to activate the enzymes, they dried it at a relatively low temperature. So not a lot of extra flavors on top of things develop. You just sort of have the flavor of the base barley. Then usually the last 10 to 15% of what you call the grain bill, what makes up what you start the beer from, will be what are called specialty malts. And those might be roasted to develop more colors and flavors. There are a couple other processing steps there. You might actually let a little bit more of the starch conversion go on before the drying to get a little bit more sugar in there in the base malt to make things sweeter. Those are called caramel malts. You can roast them to many different levels. If you look up different kinds of specialty malts, they will always usually be specified with a little degree L at the end. That stands for degrees Lovibond. That tells you what color it is. And the longer you roast a malt, much like roasting coffee people might be familiar with, it gets a darker color, and that's how you end up with darker beers. So a lot of the ways that the malt affects the final brew is what base malt do you choose? There are three or four standard varieties to choose from, and then there are many varieties of specialty malts and how much specialty malt and which varieties, and that's how you can sort of personalize a recipe and make something your own.
Well, I like beer, but I also like malted milks. And we used to get, my mom used to buy malt to make malted milks. Would that be something you would use in making beer?
No, so it is malted grain that's ground. I don't know if it would make great beer. I've never tried.
Well, that just came in off the top of my head anyway. I'm a malted milk fan, but I'm also a beer fan. But let's talk about hops.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there seems to be a ton of variety in the hops that brewers use. Can you walk us through the landscape a little bit?
Yeah, so, well, the landscape, there are now literally hundreds of varieties available to brewers, all with their own aromas. The tricky part about using hops in a recipe is that when you add the hops, actually has a big effect on how they will show up in the final product. So the one of the later stages of the brewing process, you boil the for an hour after the mashing stage where you extract and convert the sugars, you boil the wort for about an hour. So there are two main elements of hops that are going to end up in the beer. So the first is what are called alpha acids. And if you just are looking online at, say, like the specifications for hops, it'll specify a percent alpha acid. And those are what provide bittering. Because it's kind of surprising if you've ever tasted, done any home brewing, you know this, if you taste the wort. After just boiling grain, it's actually quite sweet. Once you convert all these starches to sugars, it's a little surprising. You take this non-sweet grain and boil it, it's very sweet. You need something to balance that. That's what the hops do. So the alpha acids actually are not very soluble in water in the form that they are in the hop, but as you heat treat them, they become soluble. So if you add the hops early in the boil, they undergo a chemical process called isomerization. One of the bonds in the backbone of the alpha acid sort of switches. I shouldn't talk with my hands on the radio. So that sort of changes geometry, and it changes into a different form of the molecule that's more soluble in water. So you actually get those bittering compounds in the beer. So if the hops that you add early contribute bittering. The second is that the hops have oils that have aromas to them. These are what you think of when, if you open a bag of hops and smell it, or if you just smell a nice hoppy beer, you get those hoppy aromas. Those oils are very volatile. So if you add those at the beginning of the boil, by the time you're fermenting, they're going to have boiled off and be gone. So hops that you add near the end of the boil are going to contribute those floral aromas. So you add hops early. So again, you have these two elements. One of them needs to be heat treated. One of them needs not to be heat treated. So almost all beers have more than one hop addition. Early gets you more bittering. Late gets you more aroma. And many recipes will specify, you know, add this many ounces at 45 minutes, this many ounces at 30 minutes, another dose when you're done with the boil, all just sort of tinkering with exactly how much of each of those two elements end up showing up in the final product.
There was a beer ad, which ended, it was something like, we just used the kiss of the hops. What were they trying to imply there?
I imagine that would imply quantity. Again, it's somewhat popular in sort of craft beers today to put a lot of hops in there and get a lot of bittering. Not my personal favorite. If you were, say, that wasn't your taste and you wanted to communicate, well, we're being reserved and careful with the hops, I think you might phrase it that way.
Okay. So the taste and aroma then is really changed a lot depending on the temperature changes that you have with boiling your hops and so forth.
So the boil, yes. So there's temperature control is actually very important in both the malt and the hop stages. So during what we call the mashing stage, that's where you add the milled grain to the water. That's where we extract the starch and convert it to sugar. That's very temperature sensitive, but needs to proceed at lower temperatures. So
we've got the malts and we've got the hops, and then there's the yeast.
Mm-hmm.
Some brewers grow their own cultures and maybe use the same strain over and over again, if I'm not mistaken. How do you understand that process a little better?
Yeah. So there are many strains of yeast. In my own experience, I've only ever bought them off the shelf. I've never tried to culture my own, but that would be the case where when brew is done, you can always collect the yeast and make a culture out of it. And if you do that, there's just going to be some natural evolution over time. It's going to change and change. And if you find a batch you really like, maybe you start controlling the culture.
All right. Talking with Brendan Blackwell today, who is part of the teaching faculty at UW-Madison's Engineering Department. It's great talking with him about making beer, and we'll get into the class he teaches. It sounds like class I wish I could have taken back when I was in college. Certainly, we'll look forward to your questions as well, and I hope you'll join in. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about fermentation and hearing about a beer-making class at UW-Madison and just making beer with our guest, Brendan Blackwell. He's part of the teaching faculty in UW-Madison's Engineering College of Engineering. He resides in the chemical and biological department of the college. So it's great to have him with us. Certainly, if you have questions about the chemistry and fermentation, about beer making, maybe about the class itself, you can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. A couple of emails. How long does the brewing process take from start to finish is one question.
So that depends if you're making an ale or a lager, which are the two sort of main classes of beer. So they're made by two different strains of yeast. I won't anger any biologists in the audience by mispronouncing them. But so ale yeast typically like to ferment at higher temperatures, around 65 degrees Fahrenheit or so, and lager yeast prefer much colder temperatures, around 50 Fahrenheit. So if you're making an ale, the fermentation is going to take about a week. You never exactly know when you start. So from a day to get everything in the fermenter to the primary fermentation of a week to letting it rest a little bit. Typically, you know, your beer will be drinkable somewhere between 2 and 3 weeks, depending on the exact recipe. Lagers at the colder temperature tend to need to ferment a little bit longer, in which case then you're talking about more 3 to 4 weeks in total.
Yeah, and lagers are a little more difficult to make overall, are they not?
So you do need much finer temperature control, which for home brewers can be a little bit more challenging, again, since the ale yeast like things that are close to room temperature, you know, professional brewers will hold them a little bit below room temperature, but most, if you're doing home brewing and you're making an ale, leaving it at room temperature tends to work out pretty well. For a lager, you need to hold the temperature constant down in the high 40s, low 50s for a couple weeks, and that takes specialized equipment, yes.
Yeah, it takes specialized. It's more difficult for the home brewer, for sure, and even for the microbreweries and places like that. It's going to be harder. It's more costly, let's put
Correct.
It. More costly. And another emailer wonders about yeast. The yeast, is the yeast they use the same you could buy in a packet at the grocery store, like what you use for bread?
It's the same species. There are many, many different subspecies in brewing. So you could brew with, well, the packets that you use for baking in the grocery store typically have some anti-clumping agents in them, which aren't great for brewing. Won't be catastrophic, but it won't be ideal. But it is, maybe I'll anger the biologist, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, or okay. something close to that, is the same yeast that is used in brewing that is used in baking.
And so if you're going to get the yeast, where are you going to buy it at?
Find yourself a local fermentation shop. We get ours from the Wine and Hop Shop on Monroe Street, just down the street from the university. They have it available there in plenty of different varieties, but find a fermentation shop and you should be looking to buy specifically yeast for beer.
And there's a lot of science involved with brewing, but one person here is wondering, can you describe the link between brewing and chemical engineering?
Oh, sure. So
I love that.
So one of the reasons we teach this class, anytime you're teaching any class, you sort of always have a dual purpose of you're teaching the material, but you're also trying to teach fundamental skills. And we're sending people off into so many different industries, we can't teach you, you know, every single chemical process in the world. We try to pick things that have nice core fundamentals that sort of apply to a lot of things. And that's one of the nice things about beer is you learn about things like temperature control of the process. Why do you need to do the mashing step specifically at 67 degrees Celsius? Because you have two different enzymes in there. They have different ideal temperatures. You're sort of balancing. If we want to get into the weeds, so the starches are broken down by two different enzymes called alpha amylase and beta amylase. So starches are basically big, long chain molecules of sugars. So you can imagine nice, like a string of beads that is just that we need to cut off into smaller chunks so that the yeast can eat it. What one of the enzymes does, it'll grab onto the end of the chain and sort of bite off a two two sugar long, glucose long piece. Uh-huh. That's a disaccharide called maltose. That's where malt comes from. Sometimes the names make sense. So it'll eat off the end of the chain, just sort of like popping off little sugars. The other enzyme just sort of indiscriminately picks a place along the chain and just breaks it. One of the reasons you sort of need to use them in tandem is because the starch molecules can be branched. They aren't necessarily a straight line. There might be branches like you would see on a tree. So the one that eats off the end, when it gets to the point where it branches, it can't actually eat that bond. It's stopped. So anything between inside those branched bonds, the one that's eating off the end can't get to that. So you needs to work in tandem with the one that's just sort of breaking bonds all over the place in order to get all of the starch down into fermentable sugars.
That's pretty cool.
So that's the maybe a little too in the weeds, but if we want to talk how it's chemical engineering, that's...
That's what it's all about. Mark in Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, I just drove by the Brees malting plant here in Manitowoc, and this morning they were baking, it smelled like baking bread. But anyway, I'm curious about the history of the yeast. What was the beers like several hundred years ago, or maybe even 1,000 years ago or longer? What kind of yeast did they use, and how did it affect the beer that they made?
Well, if we go back to hundreds of years ago, there wasn't quite as much understanding, so it was just wild yeast from the air. It's a lot closer to what you would use today to brew a sour beer, more than an ale or a lager. And people, again, didn't necessarily know exactly what it was, but they figured out if you take this foam off the top at the end of the process and use it again, you'll get a similar product the next time around. So the specialization is a much more modern thing, but you would get, again, something... Historically, beers would have been again, much more like a current sour.
All right. There you go, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's talk about the students that now... I was thinking about the classes I've taught at the UW here. I taught broadcasting, podcasting classes and things like that. And I make them produce their own broadcasts and podcasts as part of their assignments. So that's kind of how it works in your fermentation class or your beer making class, I think.
Yeah, so it's at its base, it's a something of a standard lab class. We have, you know, you'll show up on a Monday afternoon. We have an experimental procedure for you. We'll do experiments doing the mashing step at different temperatures and, you know, measuring sugar extraction, that kind of thing. But the really exciting part that we got to do is in collaboration with Lake Louis Brewing, we had them... We're trying to revive an old program called Campus Craft that was sort of died during the COVID era. We're trying to bring it back. So we picked a style of beer, in this case, extra special bitter. We had our students in teams of two make their own recipes, brew their own batches. And then we had some professionals come in and taste and pick a winner. And then we got to take a field trip out to Lake Louis' industrial scale facility out in Oconomowoc and brew a batch of the winning recipe.
And they had it on their...
Yes, it was. It's unfortunately sold out at this point, but for a while it was on tap at their tap room in Verona.
What was the prize among the competition? Oh,
your recipe gets to be the one that's made. Everybody gets to take some home at the end of the day.
How do the students respond to the class?
They had a great time, as you might imagine. So in addition to the field trip, it was also just a good chance for them to get a lot more hands-on engineering. Lab classes are important just to, you know, take all those nice, pretty equations we write on the whiteboard and get them in practice, actually get your hands on it. And also just getting to learn how to actually make beer and taste the final product. It was... thanks to Kirby Nelson at Lake Louis for being a great collaborator on this, and thanks to the brewers from Great Dane Carbon 4 also came in for the tasting event. I think it was really exciting for students to be able to make beer and have the professionals actually, you know, sample it.
Yeah, Lake Louis and Carbon 4 produced some really good beer, so you had some good judges for that as well. Just let's sidetrack a little bit. Let's talk about some of the other commonly fermented foods, if you don't mind. First is SCOBY. It's used in kombucha.
Yeah, so this is, again, really interesting from a chemical engineering standpoint. So beer, again, done, is fermented by yeast, which are a fungi. A lot of fermentation is done with bacteria. So the acronym SCOBX stands for Symbiotic Colony of Bacteria and Yeast. So what's really fun about this is you get a different result from having the yeast and the bacteria in there at the same time than either one on its own. So the yeast actually do some, it's usually fed by sucrose, just regular old table sugar. The yeast both produce some alcohol from that and break down some of the sucrose into glucose and fructose molecules that the bacteria can feed off of more easily. And in a SCOBY, it's what are called acetic acid bacteria. Acetic acid is the acid that's in vinegar. So they will also convert some of that sugar that the yeast broke down from them into sugar. They will convert the alcohol into the acetic acid, which is what gives kombucha its nice tangy flavor. And it'll also use some of those sugars to build what's called a pellicle. It'll turn those into cellulose. And if you've ever seen a picture of brewing kombucha, it has this weird sort of jellyfish-like thing floating on top.
Yeah.
Which is, it's sort of helps protect the colony and helps it grow. So it's the bacteria that actually make that. So the yeast and the bacteria kind of work together.
And that SCOBY actually would be pretty good for you. And you could just eat the SCOBY, I guess.
I never actually have, but they tell me you can. It looks a little weird. I don't.
So what happens with I'm not sure you've covered this, but what happens during the lactose fermentation?
So lactofermentation is a different set altogether. So that's so lactose, the sugar that's found in milk, is actually pretty rare in nature. It's not found much outside of dairy. So there are a lot of microbes that just sort of can't eat it. It's structurally very similar to a sucrose molecule, regular old table sugar. But again, this is organic chemistry. If you turn one bond the wrong way, all of a sudden it's something totally different. So there are only a couple subspecies that can actually eat lactose. And then they produce lactic acid. And actually, they can eat other things too. So for instance, the same bacteria that you would use to make yogurt are actually the same bacteria that you use to make sauerkraut or kimchi or dill pickles.
Oh, okay. Michael emailed us, how are beers made with no or reduced alcohol content? So, and those are becoming, are the no alcohol, I think, have become kind of popular.
Yeah, so to make an NA, that's typically done by producing a beer just as you would otherwise and then distilling the alcohol off. So you hold it at higher temperature. Ethanol evaporates at a lower temperature than water does. So you basically just sort of, it's more complicated than this, but you fundamentally boil off the alcohol. That can be a little tricky because boiling it for long enough to take the alcohol off is going to change some flavors.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to sort of tailor your recipe knowing that you're actually going to have that extra step. If you need to make a beer that's going to taste a little different than the final product at the stage where you would usually drink the beer because there's that extra step coming.
Here's another. Do your students sample the beer they make? Sounds like they do. Are they all 21 or older?
Yes. Yeah, 21 plus is a requirement for enrollment in the class. Long term, I'd love to develop a second fermentation class focused on, you know, non-alcoholic things that we could have a section of it teach to younger students, but that is required. And we go through, there are some legal hoops to jump through. I do exactly what the lawyers tell me to do as far as when we can and can't drink, of course.
Penny in Winona, Minnesota. It's your turn. Hi, Penny.
Yeah, hi, Larry. So I bought a hop plant many years ago at a cooperative extension, so I don't know the actual variety. I had it in a pot for many years because I didn't know where to put it. And now at my home in Minnesota, I planted it about 3 years ago, and it's like 30 feet tall every year, and it's beautiful, and I'm loaded with hops. But I'm not going to be a beer maker for sure. Is there anybody who might be interested in these gorgeous hops? I made a tincture last fall, but that's about it.
Yeah. So
if you have a friend that does some home brewing, they're going to really like you in the future.
Yeah, I would think so. There's probably Winona, Minnesota. There may be a club or an organization, you know, they're a club of home brewers that might be online. I would think that would be a possible place for you, Penny, to to stop and check. Depends on, it takes a fair amount of hops, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they are something of a specialized item. They don't really have a lot of culinary use other than beer.
Yeah, no, they don't. And they're heavy feeders, if I'm not mistaken. They're like a tobacco plant in the sense that it takes a lot of fertilizer, a lot of nitrogen to make them grow. So my advice, Penny, is go online and check for local either home brewers or home brewing clubs in your area, and you might well find somebody who is quite interested in your hops. Thank you very much for calling. Buck in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, Buck.
Hi. Great topic. I dabbled in brewing beer 40 years ago, and I learned the term Ronheitsgebot, and I'm not sure if you guys have talked about it yet because I tuned in late. But that's a German purity law that says beer can only be made from four ingredients: water, hops, barley, and yeast, and sometimes wheat. But what about all these malt beverages today with cranberry and pumpkin and all that? To me, it's ruined the industry, and I know American beer uses rice and corn. I'd just like to hear the guests' thoughts on that.
Okay. What do you think, Brendan?
I like the idea of playing with recipes, and there's always going to be, most of the industry is always going to be by the standard German definition. I think if you want to toss in an extra ingredient for a little bit of flavor and do something interesting with it, I'm not a big fan of, personally, of sweet beers. It's like I don't like a lot of fruit additions, but hey, if people are liking them, I'm not one to judge.
Yeah, and they can hide. Those kinds of beers can hide some of the problems that, you know, if you're going to make a Pilsner, for example, or a good lager, to make it well, to make a good Pilsner, I think Kirby Nelson told me that's the hardest.
Yes, the flavors are very subtle, so there are plenty of points in the brew process where there are chemical compounds that bring off flavors, whether it's, you know, you're boiling a little too low temperature, there's a little bit of a contaminant in there. Mm-hmm. And the stronger your flavor, the more of those you just sort of don't notice. So if you're doing something subtler like a Pilsner, you're always very challenging to hide the, you need to be perfect. And hey, if you make a home brew and you're like, actually, there's a little bit of off flavor, and tossing in a little bit of something else at the end makes it drinkable for you.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what happens. And a Pilsner and a lager, Glenn Clark wants to know, emailed us, how is a Pilsner different from a lager?
So a Pilsner is a type of lager. It is particularly, its base malt is what's called a Pilsner malt. It is the sort of most mildly flavors of the different base malts you can use.
And so the easiest beer for a home brewer to make, what is the easiest beer?
That probably depends where you are. As we said, there are a lot of differences in regional water, and how much you have to do to your tap water before it's usable is going to change. If you're in Madison, I would recommend starting with a stout or a porter. If you're interested in getting started out, those are typically work well with the very hard water we have here.
That makes sense. And how much does chemistry play a role in drinking beer, not just producing beer, like drinking beer from a nice glass as opposed to from a can or, you know, something else?
Well, the storage vessel has a lot more to do with, are you going to lose carbonation in storage? Does light get to beer? I mean, you typically want to keep light away from your beer as much as possible. Some of the compounds in there will react with light. So opaque storage is typically better. That's why beer bottles are typically dark, and that's why cans are good.
Yeah, that makes sense. And why does a beer get skunky? And this goes back to my youth, where my friend's father always had a particular kind of beer around, and he was not careful with it, I don't think. And it also got skunky.
So there are two things that can do that. One is light. So if it is kept in a clear bottle and it sees a lot of light, you will create a lot of those skunky flavors. Beer also doesn't respond well to changes in temperature. So, for instance, if you buy it at the grocery store from the refrigerator section, bring it home, warm it up, and put it back in the fridge again, that can also create some skunky flavors.
Oh, Well, when I bring my beer home, I take it right straight to the refrigerator. I buy it from the refrigerator and I put it in the refrigerator.
That's what you're supposed to do.
That's what you're supposed to do. It's usually the first thing I do when I get home. How'd you get interested in chemistry or fermentation?
Always just been kind of a hobby. I mean, food science has been a hobby of mine for a long time. My degrees are actually in mechanical engineering, and I'm now teaching in the chemical engineering department. And just watching my own internet research on, I like beer. I've always been interested in the process, so it's been a great thrill to actually, you know, make some of it at work.
And what's your favorite beer?
Kiss the Lips IPA from Lake Louis.
Kiss the Lips, yeah. And I tell you what, that is a good beer. I like that beer myself. You know what? It's been a pleasure talking with you today, Brandon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Appreciate it very much, and maybe we can do this again down the road. Thank you. Brendan Blackwell is part of the teaching faculty in UW-Madison's Engineering College and resides biological and chemical biological department within the College of Engineering. And it was fun talking with him. Coming up, though, we're going to take a look at something totally different. You probably don't want to be drinking a whole lot of beer when you're doing it, and that's geocaching. We'll get the ins and outs, and there's a heck of a lot going on with that in our state right now. It'll be fun talking about it with Carson Monroe. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, you can think of it as a modern-day treasure hunting form here, geocaching. It's all around us, and there are caches in, I think, most Wisconsin counties and state parks. And today we'll talk about geocachers, people who hunt for hidden objects with the help of GPS coordinates. Larry Mueller here, thanks for joining us. And great to have Carson Monroe back with us. He's the former president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. What's your handle, Carson?
My geocaching name is Acme Wildcachers.
Acme Wildcachers. In the geocaching world, that's what he's known as. And I'm wondering, do you geocache around the state? Let us know what you like about it, or maybe tell us about some of your favorite spots. What are some of your favorite experiences you've had while trying to locate a geocache? Or maybe you want to know the ins and outs of it. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Carson, again, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Geocaching is described as a real-world outdoor treasure hunting game. What are geocachers hunting, and how do they locate it?
Well, each geocache is some form of container hidden somewhere in the world. They can be big, they can be small, really anything in between. I found ones that are about the size of the end of your pinky finger. I've found geocaches that are big enough to walk into. So it really depends on what the owner wants to put out in the world for other people to find. And as for how you find it, most people these days are using a smartphone, but you can also use a dedicated GPS receiver device. Those work as well.
Yeah, the phone, though, works pretty well?
Absolutely. Yeah, these days, the GPS receivers in the phones, they're just as accurate as pretty much anything else. They'll get you to within about 20 feet of the coordinates. Of course, 20 feet of the posted coordinates could be 20 feet off for the person who hit it and then 20 feet off for you. So it's not perfect, but it'll get you close.
Yeah, and you've actually walked into one? There was one that was that big?
Yeah, there are... owners that will have like a shed on their property that the whole thing is like the geocache, and there's a big log, like a big visitor's log book and other swag trade items available in the shed. I found one in Oregon that was in a porta potty. So, yeah. You see all kinds of things.
Well, talk about some more of the common things that people might find in a cache.
Yeah, so every physical geocache should have a logbook to sign, and that's how you prove that you were there. And then ideally, you also share about your experience by logging the cache on the geocaching.com website so that other people can see and read about your experience. That also gives a notification to the owner that someone has found it, and they get to see whether you enjoyed the experience or not. You can also report if there's a problem in the cache. So every cache has to have that logbook that you can sign. Larger caches will also have trade items in them, and they're usually not expensive things, small trinkets. Some people will make signature items to put in a cache to represent themselves. Sometimes they're small coin-like items called path tags. Other times it might be wooden nickels, or you know, they make fridge magnets or any sort of small item that's likely to fit. But usually caches that are large enough will have some degree of trade items. The other thing that you might find in a cache are trackables. These are items that are designed to move between caches and be taken out of one cache and placed in another. And those can also be tracked on the geocaching.com website so you can see where they've been in the world.
And so if you're going from one place to another, then is it close by or is it?
It depends. Could be very close by. Sometimes people move them from state to state or even country to country in one hop. It really just depends on the cacher and where they're going to be geocaching.
And basically, what you've just described, are those the rules? Are there other rules that?
There are a set of guidelines that Geocaching HQ publishes for the rules of the road, so to speak. And then there are a series of local volunteer reviewers that sort of enforce those guidelines and make sure that new geocache listings meet those guidelines. So things like, you need to have permission to place a cache on whatever property, whatever place you're putting it. So sometimes that's easy. You know, in the city of Madison, for example, public city of Madison parks, geocaching is allowed within a series of guidelines that the Parks Department has established, and those are available on the Parks website. There are certain places they don't want caches to be, but in general, it's allowed, and you don't need explicit written permission. If, however, you're going to place a geocache on private property, you need to show that you have permission from the property owner to place that cache. Similarly, there is a general agreement with the Wisconsin DNR that if you submit a submission form, that caches on DNR-owned land are allowed as long as you notify them that you're placing one, and then they reserve the right to ask you to move it if there's a problem with the location or something like that.
I wonder about something like the Shawamigan National Forest, which is federally operated.
Yeah, the rules there are different, and national parks often do not allow physical geocaches. I would say most of them do not. There are a couple of cache types that are allowed, though, where you don't place a physical container to claim the find. Those are earth caches, where you learn a geological lesson and answer questions about a geological feature. Could be waterfall, bluff, you know,
yeah,
all kinds of things. There's also a virtual cache where you're not allowed to place new virtuals in general anymore, but there are virtual caches in a lot of those national parks where you go to the place and you answer a question about something. It's not necessarily a geological lesson like the earth cache, but still something to find. And the other thing you can do is you can use cache types like a multi-cache or a mystery cache where you take a person to a location where they gather some information and use that in combination with info from the cache listing to find coordinates that are not in the park. So you might highlight something that's in the park, but then the actual final hiding place is somewhere else where that cache placement is allowed.
How did you get involved in or interested in this, Carson?
Yeah, so back in probably 2005, around the time I moved to Madison area, I was listening to a podcast, which was itself kind of new at the time. It was a technology podcast, and they were talking about geocaching. They didn't describe it very well, but I was interested enough to go do a little research on my own, and I thought, wow, this sounds kind of fun. I'd kind of like to try it, but I didn't have a smartphone even at that point.
You're right.
And really nobody did.
Yeah.
And so my wife bought me a GPS receiver device for Christmas, and that was the impetus to let us try this. And so we had fun finding them occasionally over the first couple of years. And then we had kind of a lull period where we didn't find very many, and we had some children. And in 2016, when they were young and I was trying to think of things to get them out of the house, geocaching popped back into my mind, and I said, hey, we should go try this with them and see if they enjoy this like I do. And that sort of reminded me that I really enjoyed it. And since then, I've been pretty active. So
yeah.
For the last and
you're,
9 years or so.
You're former president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association.
Correct.
Which I went on the website. It's amazing, the number of spots. But tell us about the association.
Yeah, so the WGA has been around since 2002. And the WGA is really about promoting geocaching in the state of Wisconsin and making sure that geocachers can enjoy the game and that we are able to establish partnerships and agreements with landowners and parks divisions and things to make sure that geocaching can thrive, but also be respectful to the land and the areas where we play our game.
And as I looked at the website, I saw a map with that looked like the whole state of Wisconsin was covered, pretty much.
I am pretty confident there is a geocache in every county in Wisconsin, at least one. Some of them are pretty sparsely populated with caches because there are Native American reservations that may not allow caches in some areas. But I'm pretty confident that every cache right or every county right now has at least one findable geocache in it.
Have you created your own geocache?
Yes, absolutely.
what was that like?
It's been an interesting experience, and I've put out a fair variety at this point. I've also adopted some from other players who either one passed away or needed to get out of the game for other reasons. So I have a variety. I think my favorite caches to create are those that have a little bit something extra about them. So I have one in Blue Mountain State Park that requires some tools to sort of lift an internal container up through a pipe connected to a tree to get to the container where you can then sign the log. And I had one also there that someone actually took it, which was pretty disappointing, but it involved an Etch-a-Sketch and a birdhouse. But yeah, that one's gone at the moment. I've thought about trying to rebuild it a little closer to home.
Is that a problem? I mean, you're supposed to leave the cache.
Yeah, it can be a problem. One of the things I try to do is secure my caches when I can. Now, the one I was just talking about that went missing was not locked to the tree where I had it. And perhaps if it had been, it would still be there. So sometimes I will secure that. But also part of making sure caches don't go missing is being smart about where you place them. You don't want them to be in locations where just anybody will stumble across it, because if they don't understand what it is, they're probably more likely to take it or think it's something nefarious. The other thing you can do is, and what I try to do, is put an explanation of geocaching in every container so that if someone does stumble across it, they can understand that it's part of a game and it's supposed to remain. Of course, things still happen, but
yeah.
Most of mine I've had pretty good luck with the locations I've chosen.
And you mentioned tradables?
Yeah, the trackables.
Tradables?
The trade items and trackables, two different things, yes.
So what are the, describe that.
So for the trackables, they can really be anything. I think the original trackable were dog tags attached to an item, and usually it's just like a little figurine or something, but they can be anything. Usually small, because smaller means you can put them into more caches, make it easier to move them around. And some geocachers will put out caches intended to be a holding place for those kind of trade items. Usually they're called travel bug hotels, because travel bug was kind of the initial trackable type. And some people really like to move those. Other people don't really deal with that aspect of the game. But that's one of the things that I like about geocaching, is you can sort of pick and choose which aspects are for you. Myself, I like almost all aspects, but some people, they really focus on certain types of caches and they ignore others, and that's totally fine.
Yeah, it is. Carson Monroe, our guest today, former president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. He's known as Acme Wild Cachers in the geocaching world. I hope you'll join in. Are you a geocacher? Give us a call with your experiences, or maybe you've got a favorite you like to visit, or just a question about it. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Lindsay Hendrick is back to give us an update from the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and then we're going to talk about how AI is being used to sell fake plants. And then we cover all you need to know about growing a beautiful iris. So that's tomorrow. Right now, though, we're talking geocaching with our guest, Carson Monroe. He's known as Acme Wild Cachers in the geocaching world. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Mike in Fond du Lac. Mike, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to mention that biking, especially like bike trails and the parks and bike routes in cities are excellent places to find geocaches. And I've, so far, I think I've found 5,037 or something like that. I started it when I retired in 2007, and I've probably found 300 or 400 per year, the first few years anyway. The trackables, by the way, I have not seen much lately. We used to see them quite often. I wondered if there was some issue about them and if they're disappearing or what, because I don't see them in the catches very often.
Thanks for calling, Mike. Go ahead, Carson.
Regarding the trackables, I do think that they're probably a little less common than they used to be. I think the trackables, because they're designed to go in and out of caches, a lot of times they end up in the bottom of a backpack and they get forgotten and just go missing, right? So I think that some people have recognized that it is a challenge to keep a trackable going long term, and they have decided that it's not worth the time and effort. A lot of people will also buy a trackable and then put out a proxy in its place. So they can keep it going longer. If it goes missing, they can put out a new proxy in its place. But I agree. Trackables, I think, are not as popular as they once were. And part of that is just that it's hard to keep them going for a long time.
Yeah. Well, Mike, it sounds like you've had a lot of fun with geocaching on your bike.
Well, I would say it fits well with biking because, you know, even if you're doing what we call park and grabs, which I'm sure the author knows about, where you just stop every tenth of a mile and pick up another easy one from a roadside sign or something. On a bike, it's a whole lot easier than reparking and reparking all the time.
That's true, and you can cover a lot more ground on a bike. I do also like to bike for caching.
Mike, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. So how many caches do you think exist in Wisconsin?
I suppose
it's hard to know.
I think there probably are some statistics available somewhere. I would say in Madison area here, Dane County, there's over 1,000 for sure. Probably 1,500, 2,000 something in the county, in Dane County. So we obviously have a larger population here. There's going to be more caches here than there will be in some of those more rural counties, but it's several thousand for sure in the state of Wisconsin.
I'm wondering, can they be found, or do you find them in cities like?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Madison again, or Milwaukee.
Really the only requirement for where is you need to have permission, right? And be confident that it's a good place to hide the cache, but there's lots of them that are just available walking down the sidewalk in Madison or other cities. So they're not always in parks requiring hikes or biking. It really depends. There's a wide variety available.
Yeah, but then you have to sign a you have to sign. So you would have to have, I mean, you can't put it on a lamppost.
Well, actually, you can.
You can.
Yeah. So there's a couple different ways you could do that. The really small containers, we call them magnetic nanos. Those are the ones about the size of the tip of your finger. And they have just a teeny tiny log roll in the cache. Those are pretty easy to hide because they're very small. But the other thing that is really, really cool the first time you ever find one of these, but is less inspiring, let's say, after that, almost all lampposts have a skirt that covers the bolts where it connects to the footing, the concrete footing, right? That skirt lifts up, and there's a cavity in there that's perfect for hiding a cache, a small container. So those are all over the place.
Well, you've just given a tip to a lot of potential.
Yeah, if you've never found a lamp skirt geocache, now you know.
Yeah.
Or we call them an LPC, a lamppost cache.
Oh, so is that, well, that would be a common one then.
Yeah, it's pretty common.
And where else in a city would you find them?
A lot of times you'll see something magnetic under a bench, although that can be a little risky depending on the bench and how exposed it is. You'll see them hanging in trees a lot too. Evergreens are popular because they don't lose their leaves, right, in the winter, so they provide reasonable cover all year round. But you can get away with hiding them in deciduous trees as well. You just have to get a little creative.
Yeah, or if you find a hole in the tree.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, the other thing you might see in terms of urban hides is on fences. Again, magnetic is often a trend for urban hides, but there are other ways to go about it. The other thing that I really enjoy is finding a way to cleverly conceal something in a way that looks like it's part of whatever item it's hidden on, so it's really well camouflaged and tricky to find.
Yeah, so maybe paint?
Yeah, so like a bench with a hollow tube. Maybe you put something in the end of the tube, and at first glance it doesn't look out of the ordinary, but if you pull on it, it'll come right out, and there's your container. Things like that.
So if you're a beginner, where's the best place to start geocaching?
Yeah, you should go to geocaching.com or download the geocaching app available for iOS or Android and create an account. You can start for free. If you're using an app, there are some restrictions for the free style account. You can sign up for a premium account. I think it's $35 a year, somewhere in that range. And just open the app and see what's around. And there's a really good chance, if you're in a more populated area, that there's going to be a cache very close to you, maybe within easy walking distance.
Very cool. Susan in Middleton has something for us. Let's go to Susan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I'm new to geocaching. My girlfriend got me into it. She had a knee replacement a few months ago and either needed to do physical therapy or something else to get active. And she started geocaching and got me doing it. But I wanted to say that I have from Acme Wildcachers in the area found 6 of your hides.
Thank you.
Thank you for hiding caches. And Larry, I also have started doing the trackable. So when I went last summer to Europe to see the land of my grandmother and grandfather in Romania and Hungary, I left a trackable geocache in each of those cities. And I noted on the website that I would like them to come back to America to me, just like my grandparents did. And you can follow the trackables. And my grandfather has made it to Central Park. He's hiding somewhere in Central Park. And my grandmother's trackable has made it to France and seems to be stuck there. So it's really fun.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you so much for calling, Susan. Have you heard of similar stories to Susan's?
I have, yeah. So that is what a lot of people like to do, is they will give the trackable a specific mission to go to a certain country or a city, visit, and then come back to them. And while that doesn't always happen, as we talked about earlier, when it does happen, it's really cool. And I've also been able to bring a trackable back into the game. I found one probably 6 years ago or something now that had been presumed missing, and I found it and was able to get it back into circulation. And that's kind of a fun feeling too.
So it was just misplaced or?
Yeah, probably someone logged it or put it into a cache without logging that on the website. And so it was presumed to be in someone's possession, but it wasn't. It was actually sitting in a cache, and I just happened to find it there and was able to get it logged correctly into the next cache where I placed it.
Oh, very cool. And Susan, thank you so much for calling. I'm glad you're enjoying this whole process. It sounds like a lot of fun. And I guess, you think about it, is geocaching, is it all about finding the treasure at the end, or is it more than that?
I would say it's more than that, or at least it can be more than that. You know, Mike was talking about biking as a way to cache. The caches might give you destinations to bike to, or maybe the caches are along the way to something else, right? Same thing with hiking or any other type of exploration. For me, part of what I really like about geocaching, especially in the area around here where I live, is a geocache will take me to a place that I wouldn't really have a reason to go otherwise. And oftentimes I see really interesting and cool things that I never would have seen. So I have a friend who likes to put geocaches next to artwork that is visible from the street or the sidewalk or whatever, and highlight those. And that's taken me to see a lot of these sculptures and paintings and other things that I might have missed or never had a reason to see otherwise. So that's a pretty cool aspect of geocaching.
That is very cool. Does geocaching tend to attract younger or older people? Or
It's a mix, but I would say older, and probably older than me. You know, I'm early 40s, but
yeah.
There are a lot of folks that are retired that gives them more time to cache, and so they're more prolific in the game. But I also have some friends that are younger than me that cache too. So it's a variety, and it's a good thing to do with kids. You know, I have children that are 10 and 12, and they still tolerate geocaching some of the time. So, yeah.
They haven't reached that teenage. They're almost there, though. Oh my goodness. Well, what are some good ideas for cash items?
For trade items? Mm-hmm. So I like to use little mm-hmm. you know, the twisted nails,
yeah.
Or little, you know, move the marble through the maze only in miniature, or figurines, mm-hmm. or bracelets. Like sometimes my daughters like to make friendship bracelets and we'll mm-hmm. put those in caches. So really, to me, it's something that is small enough to fit into a cache, mm-hmm. not expensive, because I don't want to spend a lot of money on things that I'm really giving away, but also not just junk, right? Something that kind of rides that line. It's interesting enough that it may interest someone. Sometimes I'll also put in items that may be more attractive to adults, like a multi-tool or multi-part screwdriver or something like that. Those items cost a little bit more, but depending on the type of cache I'm putting out, that could also be appropriate.
Hmm. Dave and Broadhead, do you have a quick comment or question?
Now, I'm just wondering, are there businesses that put geocaches in their business, or, you know, other organizations that do that just to bring people in?
Yes and no. There are guidelines around commercial limitations. So you can have a cache placed at a business. Usually it's not inside because you want it to be available most of the time. Obviously you would need permission from the business, but that does happen. And there are also things called geotours where there's a more official partnership, and that's where some commercial businesses are more often involved.
Oh, on that note, Carson, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for coming back and being with us again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was great.
Carson Monroe, former president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. And take a look at its website if you want to learn more, for sure, because there's a lot there. Big thanks to you for listening, and to our group of people, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, Clara Neipert, and Joel Patnod, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and again, stay with us. Lots more in store.